This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Why is it that with sparkling water, I'm always playing guessing games with what flavor I'm drinking? Is it citrus? Is it aluminum can flavored? Not sure. Sparkling ice, though, they really mean flavor. Like in-your-face flavor. Orange mango, black raspberry. Don't even get me started on the strawberry lemonade. Kiwi strawberry slid right into my taste buds' DMs last night and let them know who's boss. No subtleties there, and no sugar either. But it does have vitamins and antioxidants. Find sparkling ice at a major grocery store or club retailer near you. Sparkling ice. Anything but subtle.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm very pleased today to be speaking to Dr. Michael Ortiz about his book published by Bloomsbury titled Anti-Colonialism and the Crises of Interwar Fascism, which is a really interesting book that asks some big questions, some important questions. I'm trying not to give away the cool parts before we get to them. But really, this is a book of interest to people thinking about empire, people thinking about fascism, people thinking about the early 20th century in Europe, but actually quite a lot more than that. So, Michael, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
Could you start us off, please, by introducing yourself a little bit and explain why you decided to write this book?
Sure. Thank you. So my name, as you mentioned, is Michael Ortiz. I'm an assistant professor of modern Europe and empire at the University of Rhode Island. And this book, it was actually originally my dissertation when I was a grad student at the University of Colorado Boulder. And it originated in the Asian and African Studies reading room at the British Library. So when I was a graduate student, I was poring through British records relating to the Spanish Civil War. And, you know, I've spent quite a bit of time in Spain. I have family that live there. And so the Spanish Civil War has always been something that fascinated me. And so while poring through these records, I came across a speech delivered by Jawaharlal Nehru. The speech itself was compelling, but what I found irresistible was actually its geography. Nehru was in Barcelona addressing the government of the Second Spanish Republic. And I kept coming back to this question of why. Sort of, why was Nehru in Barcelona? He was one of the leaders of the Congress-led campaign for independence in India. And I assumed that this was an all-encompassing endeavor, yet here he was in Barcelona. And as is so often the case for historians, sort of questions begot more questions. Things like, in addition to Nehru, did other anti-colonialists visit Spain? Where else did they travel? Fortunately, I was in an archive, so I began digging. And what I soon discovered is that Indian anti-colonialists, elite Indian anti-colonialists, followed, analyzed, and in many cases intervened in some of the crises that precipitated the Second World War. So very quickly, my initial research question broadened from why was Nehru in Spain to how did Indian anti-colonialists understand these crises of fascism? And this was kind of a difficult task. I'm a historian of modern Europe and empire, not a historian of South Asia. And it was difficult, as you might imagine, to connect the rather dense historiographies of things like the Spanish Civil War and the Indian campaign for independence, to say nothing of the myriad other crises that I'm engaging with. And so on the surface, I based strictly on the individuals I engage with, I think this book can appear to be a book about the Indian campaign for independence. And what I've tried to do, and hopefully accomplish, is something different. And that is to sort of demonstrate the ways in which Indian understandings of these crises transform our understanding of interwar Europe. or as I say in the book, or sort of my elevator pitch, I try to pitch it as a colonial history of interwar fascism.
A great introduction, I think, to this. And of course, I always am a fan of anything where the story starts with, well, I was in an archive and, right?
Yeah.
So given that background and kind of that elevator pitch you ended with, could you tell us a bit more about the myths or assumptions that you're challenging in the book and why we should be doing that challenging?
Yeah, oh, that's a fantastic question. I'll give you two. So when I first began this research, fascism was still mostly analyzed as a distinctly European phenomenon. And there was there still is considerable debate over what scholars refer to as the fascist minimum, or the minimum characteristics that qualify one as fascist. Yet most of these frameworks were deployed within Europe, and they would oftentimes parse through considerable minutiae. Occasionally, there would be a throwaway sentence, or if you're lucky, a paragraph explaining why fascism was restricted to Europe. Something along the lines of, various nations outside of Europe were dominated by imperial nations, African, Asian, and American colonies evolved differently than their European metropoles, precluding organic fascisms from emerging. Well, as you might imagine, my eyebrows raised considerably when I came across Indian anti-colonialists contending that they already knew fascism, or they had already experienced fascism, because they had suffered under the boot of what they called British fascism in India for more than a century. And it's this disjuncture of whether fascism existed outside of Europe or not that I found really fascinating. And really, in the last couple of decades, a number of scholars have really reconceptualized how we understand the origins and the rise of fascism. Daniel Hettinger, Nigel Copsey, Benjamin Zachariah, they've all really sort of reoriented our understanding of fascism. It's not really something that emerged in Italy and was copied sort of imperfectly outside of Europe, but really rather as a sort of global phenomenon that merged with local discourses. I think the term glocal is often used in this sort of complex process of mutual radicalization. So this shift has allowed us to sort of broaden the scope with which we analyze fascism, and scholars have done fantastic work analyzing movements around the world. Now, my own intervention in this shift and the assumption I aimed to challenge was slightly different. A lot of the scholarship has examined the emergence of fascisms outside of Europe and really challenged the notion that fascism only existed within Europe. And at the same time, you also have another group of scholars that has examined what I often call anti-colonial anti-fascism. What I mean by that is the ways in which anti-colonialists incorporated anti-fascist discourses within their existing campaigns for independence. Michelle Lauro, for example, has a great book examining Nehruvian anti-fascism. And Leslie James also has a terrific article examining Caribbean and West African anti-colonial anti-fascism. And so what my book does, or at least what I hope it does, is something a bit different. I seek to analyze anti-colonial understandings of fascism to see how they support or challenge how Europe sees itself. So, for example, we are often told that the crises that precipitated the Second World War pitted the liberal democracies, England and France, against fascist Italy and Nazi Germany. And what my book argues instead is that this is not quite this sort of Manichaean confrontation, and that particularly when you see these crises and this sort of brewing conflict from India, from the perspective of Indian anti-colonialists, Britain, France, Italy, and Germany were far more similar than they cared to admit. And that scene from India, they're simply a collection of great power imperialists squabbling, as imperialists often do. And so accordingly, these crises of fascism, as I refer to them, are essentially a clash of fascist empires versus liberal empires. And before I go on, let me state one thing I strive to accomplish many times in this book is disassociate my own analysis from that of Indian anti-colonialists. There are plenty of instances where, in my own opinion, Indian anti-colonialists get it wrong. So in the book, I try to go out of my way not to conflate fascism and imperialism. There are numerous reasons why they are not the same, demographics, for example. At the same time, I do believe they're interrelated in that for too long, we have sort of bifurcated our analysis, where we focus on fascism in Europe in imperialism outside of Europe. And so this book is just one attempt to try and bring these two phenomena or lenses together. This might all sound somewhat esoteric, so can I give you a specific example of what I mean by this, which I guess will serve as my second example? Yeah, okay. So I'll give you a sort of quick, the Munich Agreement, right? I assume your listeners are probably familiar with it, but in late 1938, British Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain appeases Nazi aggression by negotiating the transfer of the Sudetenland, which is part of Czechoslovakia, over to Hitler. Now, scholars have long debated whether this was a catastrophe or a shrewd political maneuver, with most, I suspect, believing the former, and there is, of course, considerable middle ground there. Yet what unites nearly all of this scholarship is that it contends that the Munich Agreement was a singular and momentous event, something significant or even evocative. Even A.J.P. Taylor, the sort of great revisionist of British foreign policy, who defended the Munich Agreement, argued it was a singular and important event. Well, when you analyze the Munich Agreement from the perspective of Indian anti-colonialists, it's not singular, it's not unique, nor even important. From their perspective, it is simply great power imperialists redrawing a map to prevent war. Now, this is something that happened quite frequently in the colonial world, most famously, I would say, during the Berlin Conference in the late 19th century. But because it happened within Europe, we are often told or understand it as extraordinary. And so this is, I think, a useful example for seeing how analyzing these crises from the perspective of anti-colonialists outside Europe and really sort of trying to transcend the imaginary boundaries between, you know, Europe and empire might affect how Europeans understand their own history.
No, that was a great example. So thank you for adding that in. Given that you've so kind of clearly laid out why we need to be looking from these vantage points and what sort of the stakes are, can you tell us a bit more about kind of how you do it in the book? You use case studies, sort of interrelated, five interrelated instances to actually do this looking at it from a different perspective. What are the five and how did you choose them?
Sure, absolutely. So when I was pouring through the numerous anti-colonialists that engaged with the rise of fascism, I actually very quickly became overwhelmed with the amount of information. It's funny, I actually had been initially worried that there would not be enough material to write a whole book about anti-colonial involvement in the Spanish Civil War, but then was very pleasantly and also terrifyingly surprised at the level of engagement, not only in India, but around the world. And so ultimately, what I decided to do was structure each chapter of the book around a particular crisis. And with that, to sort of hone my analysis to follow one particular anti-colonialist. Although not exclusively, I think if you've read it, there's a significant roster that finds themselves within every chapter. And it just so happens that every chapter follows these crises and they actually occur sequentially. So I begin in the first chapter with the Italian invasion of Ethiopia in 1935. The second chapter focuses on the Spanish Civil War. The third examines what many people call the Second Sino-Japanese War, the Japanese invasion of China in 1937. The fourth, as I mentioned, talks about the Munich Agreement. And the final chapter engages with the onset of war between Britain and Germany, and does it kind of ends around 1941 when the Soviet Union gets involved, but in some ways goes on to the end of the war. And as I sort of just mentioned, my larger argument is attempting in many ways to reframe these crises as clashes between rival imperialisms rather than the sort of traditional narrative of fascism versus liberalism.
Thank you for that. I mean, I always feel bad asking people to explain their case studies because it's like asking you to condense so much into one answer. but that gives us at least an outline. But I do plan to now ask you to go into more detail. So that's not the only time we're going to talk about the case studies.
Okay.
Let's start with the Second Italian-Ethiopian War. And can we use that as an example to exactly make this point that it's not between sort of fascism or liberals? Actually, there's quite a lot of similarities if you look at both of them in terms of imperialism.
Yeah. This is, I think, a great example, and that's a wonderful question. Of all the case studies I would say that this one is the most straightforward. In the past few decades, there's been considerable scholarship examining the transnational and really global response to the Italian invasion of Ethiopia, which happens in October 1935, particularly from within the Black and African diaspora in the United States and Afro-Caribbean, for example, but also present-day Ghana, Kenya, and elsewhere. And as I was researching this, what I found really interesting was that Indian anti-colonialists adopted very similar rhetoric, criticizing Italy, and expressed considerable solidarity with Ethiopia. So it was really fascinating from my perspective to connect Indian anti-colonialism to similar iterations being articulated from within the African diaspora. Now, I want to begin sort of in Europe, right? Because this invasion is often depicted as the high water mark of Italian imperialism, with Mussolini triumphant. It is moreover seen as the beginning of this Italian-German detente. They had previously been in somewhat of a Cold War, interestingly enough, over Austria. Mussolini actually briefly considers an alliance, a formal diplomatic alliance with Britain and France. And it's actually, this is sort of not related, but it's really interesting because if I'm not mistaken, when this war breaks out, Nazi Germany even supplies Ethiopia with a small amount of material support, weapons and ammunition, because Hitler wanted to weaken Italy or sort of bog down this war before he attempted an Anschluss with Austria. Finally, to get back to your question, together with the Japanese invasion of Manchuria in 1931, this conflict is often seen as the beginning or origins of British appeasement of fascist aggression. Put simply, it is sort of referred to as the dawn of fascist expansionism, which eventually culminates in the Second World War, and really the beginning of the division of Europe into fascist and liberal blocs. The Rome-Berlin Axis, for example, where the term the Axis for during the Second World War comes from, is announced not long after the end of this conflict. Hitler and Mussolini come to a sort of an agreement as a result of this war. So this chapter centers on Rajani Pamdut, the protagonist for this chapter, and he rejects all of this, all of these sort of arguments. And what he contends is that rather than dividing Europe, the Italian invasion of Ethiopia actually reveals the similarities between what he calls fascist imperialism and liberal imperialism. And his rationale is that these nations have simply revivified the new imperialist covenant. And I want to pull back for a second here, because the term new imperialism is often ill-defined. It's this sort of protean, vague term. It refers back to the late 19th century when Europe's great powers gathered, most famously at Berlin in 1884, to formalize and organize the conquest of much of the African continent, so as, among other things, to prevent a continental war. So Dutt claims that the behavior of the British government during the Second Italo-Ethiopian War is evidence that Europe has simply returned, if it ever left, to imperial great power negotiations to prevent world war. And he says that, at least outside of Europe, Italy, Britain, Germany, France are all essentially great power imperialists who are willing to bargain over the fate of non-European and non-white nations. British non-intervention in this conflict, he argues, represents tacit British support for the Italian invasion of Ethiopia. And it should be mentioned, this is nearly the exactly the same position that the British government assumed during the First Italo-Ethiopian War in 1895, when Ethiopia actually defeats Italy, famously at the Battle of Ottawa. So what Dutt is saying, and what I'm trying to sort of articulate here, is that at the same time this is in many ways the dawn of fascist expansionism, this event in many ways is also the continuation, or perhaps conclusion, of new imperialism and the scramble for Africa. And I'll finish just by saying that I think this conclusion hints at why it is so important to analyze these crises or European fascisms from non-European perspectives. Because within Europe, and this is sort of a theme of the book, the differences between liberalism, fascism, conservatism matter in stark and meaningful ways. Yet outside of Europe, each of these nations tended to appear as great power imperialists negotiating the fate of non-European nations. And really up until, I'd say, relatively recently, we tended to only learn about one of these perspectives.
It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. You might say all kinds of stuff when things go wrong, but these are the words you really need to remember. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. They've got options to fit your unique insurance needs, meaning you can talk to your agent to choose the coverage you need, have coverage options to protect the things you value most, file a claim right on the State Farm mobile app, and even reach a real person when you need to talk to someone. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
And it is so convenient from a historical perspective that the first example chronologically is such a clear-cut example of the point you're making. So thank you for taking us through that one. To go back to, I suppose, well, the next one chronologically, but your kind of original impetus into investigating this, can we turn to the Spanish Civil War and how Indian anti-fascists looked at that in the context of already examining their relationship with Britain and India and their campaign for independence?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll try to keep my answer short on this one because this is one of the most fascinating aspects of, in my opinion, of the book. I make very clear my sort of fascination of the Spanish Civil War. So this chapter centers on Nehru, who I've already mentioned, and who is very much a romantic, sort of preoccupied with European affairs. There are many, many South Asian scholars that have argued that this was part of a sort of neo-colonial Indian bourgeoisie who predominated over a transfer of power rather than Indian emancipation. But regardless of the why, Spain utterly captivates Nehru. And this is not necessarily uncommon. From its inception, the Spanish Civil War captured the hearts and minds of individuals from around the world. Myself included, it is very famously referred to as the last great cause. And one of the reasons for this is, I believe, that the war in many ways functioned as a sort of Rorschach test. Any Spanish scholar will tell you that the Spanish Civil War is a distinctly Spanish conflict. It sort of reflects and articulates much of Spanish history and the sort of peculiarities and uniqueness of Spanish culture and history, etc. But in my opinion, the war possessed enough ideological malleability and, frankly, complexity that individuals could oftentimes project their own struggles and worldviews upon it, whether that be fascism versus freedom, Bolshevism versus Catholicism, or even communism versus anarchism versus fascism. And interestingly, what Nehru identifies in this war is what I think is an altogether new perspective. Similar to what we just discussed in the during the Italian invasion of Ethiopia, he actually sees it as an imperial transaction between satisfied, so Britain and France, and unsatisfied powers, Spain, Italy, and Germany. When I say Spain, I mean the nationalists. So Nehru argues that fascism is simply a radicalized form of imperialism, that the post-First World War Treaty of Versailles carved up what remained of the world, radicalizing imperialist movements in Italy and Germany, who now, without any horizons to aim their colonial gaze, turn inward, both towards their own people and Europe itself. So in Spain, Nehru sees new fascist empires asserting themselves against the older liberal empires. And so for him, the war in this way is imaginably anti-imperialist, and that the Republic is fighting against fascist empires as well as the non-intervention of liberal empires. And to him, this struggle, these struggles are remarkably interrelated. And I'll give you just one example of the ways he draws these parallels. Your listeners have probably heard of the very famous bombing of Guernica, which for so many Europeans harkened a new age of aerial devastation and destruction. The bombing, Guernica is in the north, in the sort of Basque region in northern Spain. And the bombing occurred on market day, in which civilians from the surrounding area had all gathered, many of whom were perished or were injured. And as you might imagine, the bombing elicits a howl of protest and quite a bit of condemnation from within Britain. Nehru, once again, has a different perspective, because at the same time, German and Spanish nationalist planes are bombing Guernica, northern Spain, British planes are bombing the northwest frontier of India during what they called the Waziristan campaign. And Nehru plainly asks the people that are condemning the bombing of Guernica, what's the difference? Why are you condemning this bombing, but not the one that's happening in the northwest frontier of India? So he's drawing these parallels between imperialism in India and fascism in Europe. And it should be mentioned that he's drawing these parallels on multiple sides. And this kind of gets to your question. And what's remarkable is he's not shy about this. He comes right out and says that the struggle in Spain and the Congress-led campaign against the British Empire are one and the same, that they're both struggling against European imperialism. And this answers the question I proposed at the very beginning, right? Why was Nehru in Barcelona to support the Second Republic? Because in his mind, he sees it as part of his own campaign against inequality, against exploitation, against this broader sense of imperialism. So he organizes, he calls it an Aid Spain campaign to support the Republic. He gathers foodstuffs for the Republic. They're chronically underfed. He dispatches a medical mission with a doctor and an ambulance, and he travels to Barcelona to voice his support. And these actions, as I mentioned in the book, do generate some controversy back in India. Nehru, moreover, his actions sort of create these paradoxes. To give you just one example, he's constantly urging the British government to intervene on behalf of the Republic, but doesn't quite acknowledge that doing so would sort of mobilize the British imperial war machine against which he had devoted his life. And there are actually quite a few anti-fascists in England who feel betrayed by Nehru a few years later when Britain does finally declare war against Germany and Nehru does not support the British war effort. But these are contradictions that Nehru never really acknowledges nor addresses.
But very interesting aspects. So I can see why this would be perhaps the case study that you find most intriguing. I admit, though, that mine might be the next one. So if I can ask you to move over to talking about Japanese fascism and the parallels that Indian anti-fascists saw between this and British imperialism.
Sure. This is another good one. So Japan launches a full-scale invasion of China in 1937. Many historians, actually myself included, would consider this the outbreak of the Second World War. Yet this invasion culminated decades of expansion and aggression. And what's interesting is that for much of the early 20th century, the first decade or so, Japan was very much considered an anti-colonial paragon. It famously defeated Russia in the 1905 Russo-Japanese War, which electrified anti-colonialists around the world. And so many looked to Japan as a model or archetype of sort of this anti-Western anti-colonialism or national regeneration. By the 1930s, this reputation is somewhat fractured. Japan's invasion of Manchuria in 1931 shatters much of this sort of anti-colonial image. And many people begin wondering whether Japan has simply adopted imperial discourses to create an empire of their own. There are numerous Indian anti-colonialists that refer to Japan as, this is quote unquote, the British of the East. And so my argument in this chapter centers once again on British non-intervention in this conflict. So Britain possessed several treaty ports along the coast of China and had been a major imperial power in the region, though this had deteriorated just somewhat after the First World War. And a lot of prevailing scholarship has characterized British non-intervention as, the quote I use is, benevolent neutrality. That given this sort of impending war against Germany, Britain lacked the resources to fully commit to confronting Japan. And so it sympathized with China, kind of did what it could, but ultimately it had to watch sort of powerless as China waged this brutal conflict, so that it could prioritize the war against Germany. Now, Indian anti-imperialists saw the conflict in quite a different way. And by this point, you're going to hear me say this. You're probably detecting a theme, right? Many contended that while the British government currently sympathized with China, it had nevertheless historically created a precedent of imperial exploitation. It had weakened the Chinese state for its own exploitation. Think of things like the Opium Wars, the Boxer Rebellion, while also establishing imperialism as a marker of success and martial prowess, something that Indian anti-colonialists claimed that Japan was trying to emulate. So Indian anti-colonialists argue that as Japan is looking outwards to assert its sort of nationhood and assert its imperial might, it encounters a world largely colonized by European powers. At the time, many people called this the ABCD, or the American, British, Chinese, and Dutch encirclement. So anti-colonialists argue that British imperialism is in many ways both influencing Japanese expansionism as a sort of model of modernity, of civilizational prowess, of sort of, you know, imperial power, while also in many ways directing it towards China by, one, weakening the Chinese state and making it vulnerable to colonization. Now, I should mention the principal anti-imperialist I analyze in this chapter, the protagonist for this one, is Subhas Bose. And if your listeners are familiar with Bose, it's probably from his actions during the Second World War. He very famously flees India, first to join the Nazis in Berlin, and then eventually Japan, where he assumes control of the Indian National Army and leads a Japanese-supported invasion of India. Eventually he's defeated. He dies in a plane crash. Now, Bose is a fascinating prism from which to analyze the Second Sino-Japanese War. So this war breaks out and is actually the same year that he is elected president of the Indian National Congress in 1937. He's actually elected again in 1938 against the wishes of Gandhi, but then Gandhi sort of orchestrates his ouster from behind the scenes. And I really like this chapter following the Spanish Civil War because, unlike the romantic Nehru, Bose is utterly pragmatic. So he is, for example, one of the voices criticizing Nehru for dispatching foodstuffs to Spain when there are several hundreds of thousands, even millions of people in India that are starving. And in my opinion, this is a very reasonable critique, right? And what's really interesting is that even in 1937, you can see that Bose is reluctant to criticize Japan, but that he is also sympathizing with China. And so much of his frustration and anger in this conflict is directed principally at the British Empire, and of course, Chiang Kai-shek, the leader of the Chinese nationalists. And Bose has this incredible claim that he believes that Chiang will abandon China and become an ally of the Japanese, which is so fascinating, given what Bose is eventually going to do in 5 years, right? Leave India and become an ally of Japan and try to liberate India. But I make very clear, you know, Bose is a very controversial figure. There's radically different interpretations of his actions, you know, within Europe and in South Asia. And at least in 1937, and I feel like I can say this somewhat confidently, Bose walks this very fine line that doesn't necessarily augur his wartime actions. But at the same time, what you can begin to see is the monomaniacal way that he desires independence, his sort of willingness, or unwillingness, I should say, to criticize any potential ally in the campaign for independence.
That example obviously helps make the wider point, but also, as you said, within it is really interesting if you go on to think what happens 5 years later with some of these key figures.
Yeah.
That one might be my favorite, but it might also be the next one. So I admit I didn't quite have to choose a favorite. So let's go to the next one because maybe listeners will want to like this one too. We've talked a little bit about the Munich Agreement already and the idea that it might be related to the scramble for Africa than we might traditionally tell the story in Europe. Can we talk about that a bit more and maybe pull in other things like the Treaty of Versailles?
So I touched on this earlier, but in many ways, the redrawing of the map of Europe by these sort of great powers in order to forestall war is a very recurrent theme in the historiography of empire. So from the Indian perspective, the Munich Agreement is simply another imperial transaction, right? Similar to the ways that great power imperialists carved up West Asia or the Middle East after the First World War, or the interior of Africa during the scramble, or even, and now I'm sort of jumping timelines, the partition of India after the Second World War, right? This is a very common occurrence. It should be mentioned, moreover, that Czech officials were not invited to participate. They had to wait in the next room of this as the sort of big four, or Mussolini, Hitler, Daladier, and Chamberlain are, you know, discussing what to do with the Sudetenland. But it's also consistent with how these conferences often proceed. And again, kind of gives support, not necessarily that fascism is imperialism, but that a lot of what fascists are doing is are invoking this sort of imperial tradition. The person, the protagonist that I follow in this chapter is actually Gandhi. And along those lines, I think what one of the other thing that I really find interesting about this chapter is it illustrates the limitations of seeing fascism and imperialism as identical phenomenon. So this takes place in late 1938. And at this point, Gandhi is getting older. He's suffering from a variety of health issues and is in the process of feeling marginalized by a new generation of anti-colonialists. There are moreover larger issues regarding British censorship and other forms of sort of limited information. That being said, Gandhi largely misunderstands the nature of Nazi violence, because as Europe prepares for war over the Sudetenland in the sort of weeks and months leading up to the Munich Agreement, people keep asking him, they seek him out and ask him if his technique of nonviolence would be effective against the fascist dictators. And of course, Gandhi says yes, right? He believes in the universality of his doctrine the same way philosophers, most philosophers do, Marx, Hegel, you know, the list goes on. And it's, I found this really interesting because I open and close, Miranda, I don't know if you remember this chapter, with the letters that Gandhi actually writes to Hitler, both before mm-hmm. and after the war has broken out. And censors intercept them, of course. But what is striking to me is that these letters are so remarkably sincere. In these letters to Hitler, and really together with all of his speeches and writing, Gandhi contends outright that his technique of nonviolence would delegitimize the Nazi regime in the same way it had delegitimized the British in India. So in many ways, he's conflating British imperial and Nazi violence. Yet as history has shown, and as I argue, they are interrelated, and in my opinion, both deplorable, but the scale and the scope of Nazi violence is different. And I'll give you just one specific example of what I mean by that. Gandhian nonviolence was crafted to fight the peculiarities of British imperialism, and it relied accordingly on particular factors that would have been unimaginable in Germany. Demographics, right? Indians vastly outnumbered British imperial forces in the subcontinent, and they often leveraged this demographic strength in their nonviolent protests. Whereas by contrast in Germany, Jews, LGBTQ, Roma, and other persecuted groups were a tiny minority. So Gandhian nonviolence, in my opinion, would not have been, this is a hypothetical which historians tend to loathe, but I don't think it would have been particularly effective against Nazism. And I think it's important to mention this and sort of, and you know, talk about this, because I'm frequently arguing that fascist and imperialist regimes were interrelated and far more similar than either cared to admit. But it's, at the same time, I want to sort of make this point that they're not, I don't want to conflate them, that they are not necessarily the same.
Hey, welcome to IKEA, where even this desk is circular.
Huh. How so? Looks pretty rectangular to me.
It's because we're always looking to repair, reuse, and relove our products, like buying back your IKEA items for store credit. Or shop our as-is section for great deals. You can even order free spare parts. Get on the circular path for a more sustainable future.
Still a rectangle.
Get started at ikea-usa.com/circular. Visit ikea-usa.com/circular for as-is information and buyback and resale terms and conditions. Spare parts not available for all products.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code Spotify for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Nope, fair enough, but still worth putting them in conversation with each other and seeing very much what comes out. So thank you for doing that instance, obviously with caveats as necessary, but that doesn't mean we can't do analysis. Mm-hmm. Can we then move, I suppose, I mean, we have been jumping a little bit around chronologically, but let's focus then on the Second World War, if we're already talking about things like Munich. You have a great quote. I'm not even going to try to rephrase it because this does it better than I do. Perhaps more than any other nation, India understood the Second World War across an ethical spectrum. Tell us what you mean by this.
Absolutely. So in September of 1939, war breaks out between England and Germany. And I think in this situation, most of us, if we were in Europe at the time, we would sympathize with Britain. You have the fall of France, the tragedy of the Blitz, the sacrifices of so many British citizens in the face of this repugnant Nazi ideology. It's inspiring. But in India, and really across the British Empire, the reaction is far more muted. And in India specifically, the outbreak of the war, I would characterize it as complicated. And imagine for a second, if you will, that you are an Indian anti-colonialist. This war pits a nation that for more than a century has asserted that you are civilizationally and racially inferior. It has plundered your natural resources, your wealth, your ingenuity, and it has committed, moreover, in addition to the sort of systemic violence of imperialism, committed overt violence and atrocities against your people. I'm thinking here of the 1857 rebellion, but also incidents like the Jallianwala Bagh massacre in 1919. And continues, moreover, to commit violence against nonviolent protesters in these sort of massive Gandhian Satyagraha campaigns. And on top of that, refuses to leave under any circumstances. And now this colonial overlord is engaged in a war and demanding that you sacrifice your people, your wealth, other things to support it. That's a tough pill to swallow. But then at the same time, you are probably well aware at this point of the odiousness of Nazism. You can probably see plainly that this is simply another iteration of imperialism that would seek to dominate you in much the same fashion, or worse, as the British. And actually, the few excerpts we have of Hitler speaking about India largely corroborate this notion. Halifax, the sort of high up member of the national government, travels to visit Hitler in 1938 in the sort of lead up to Munich. And Hitler at one point tells him, you should just shoot Gandhi, right? And execute anti-colonialists every day more and more and more until the anti-colonial movement is defeated. So you're well aware of the sort of radical, violent approach of the Nazis. So how would you, I'm not asking you directly, Miranda, but you know, how do you react to this war breaking out? Do you support the British, against whom you've devoted your life, or the Nazis? And this is a paradox, right? This is a very difficult situation. And I'll point out once again that this is yet another instance of why I think it is important to analyze European events from the perspective of non-European actors, because it offers such interesting perspectives. So pulling back just a little bit, all the mainstream anti-colonial movements answer this question differently, right? The Muslim League supports the British war effort. The Congress demands a guarantee of independence. They say, if you promise independence after the war, we will support it unequivocally. We will throw ourselves into this conflict because we recognize the threat, the peril of Nazism. In response, the British, of course, obfuscate. They stall. And eventually, they just imprison the Congress for the duration of the war. And then outside of the sort of mainstream anti-colonial movements, you also have the British Indian Army, which is substantially large and fights in nearly every theater of war. And as previously mentioned, you have the Indian National Army led by Subhas Bose, which orchestrates a failed liberation of India as an ally of Japan. So India is intimately involved in just about every theater of the Second World War. And the person I engage with in this chapter is really beyond any of these experiences and is a remarkably unique individual, M.N. Roy. Whom I find endlessly fascinating. So by the time the war has broken out, Roy on the surface is well outside the mainstream of Indian politics. He was a famous anti-colonialist for much of the first decades of the 20th century. He is indicted in numerous conspiracy trials. He actually travels to the Soviet Union and is very intimately involved in the first 5 to 10 years of Soviet politics. He returns to India in 1930 and is imprisoned for several years. He's released eventually. And what's interesting about Roy is he loathes Gandhi. In the 1930s, he's still somewhat of a communist, and so very much hates Gandhi and nonviolence, and writes frequently about Gandhi. Gandhi, you get the sense, also hates Roy, but he never mentions him. Because, you know, Gandhi's at the top. He doesn't have to sort of punch down. And Roy never really gains the mass following he probably thought he deserved. But he nevertheless proposes a fascinating solution to the sort of paradox or this question or this ethical spectrum that I just mentioned, right? He urges all Indians to support the British war effort because he believes that the British war effort will be an all-consuming endeavor that will exhaust politically, economically, morally, socially, the British Empire and inaugurate an era of decolonization in India. So he essentially says, support Britain because we need to defeat the Nazis. But the good news is doing so will require a Herculean effort on the part of the British that will animate and compel the collapse of the British Empire. And I find this, when I was reading this, I found it fascinating, and I'm being intentionally reductive here, but this is essentially what happens, right? The British win the war, you know, with the support of the Soviet Union and the Americans, and then 2 years later, in 1947, India achieves independence. And so Roy is very much sort of has this very fascinating perspective that I think sort of predicts there are many limitations to this, and there are many situations in which he gets it wrong. But for at least on this sort of perspective, I think he proposes an interesting, I don't know if you want to call it solution, but an answer to that question. And I should mention that this was not easy for Roy to do, right? He spent a decade in Russia. He had devoted himself to toppling the British Empire. And the British, moreover, they even keep him on house arrest, even though he's one of the few anti-colonialists loudly supporting the British war effort. So there's layers to how it's just sort of interesting this guy is.
Yeah, no, lots of layers. And I think this is, I mean, I can't believe I haven't said it already, right? But this is a good point to remind listeners that the book has way more detail. So if you want to get into these layers in more depth, you can, you know, read the whole book. That's definitely an option. Moving through it then, as we continue to, can we sort of, I guess we've finished in some ways the five case studies. I hesitate to say finished, given how much we've done a highlights version of it, but we've moved towards the end of the book. Can you talk about the idea that European colonialism is creating a boomerang effect?
Yeah, that's a great question. Excuse me. So the boomerang effect is a quote, and it's coined, it's a phrase, I should say, coined by one of the great historians of the 20th century, Hannah Arendt. I think most famous for the sort of totalitarian theory. And the boomerang effect essentially proposes this idea that Europe and its colonies are not isolated, rather that they are intertwined and that they informed one another through mutually constitutive discourses. So what Arendt is arguing is that colonial violence abroad, so for example, this is most frequently brought up as a sort of example, German genocide in Southwest Africa and present-day Namibia presaged Nazism, or more broadly, that colonial violence abroad essentially boomeranged back into Europe in the form of fascism, that you can't essentially disassociate the violence that Europeans are committing abroad and simply say that it didn't affect what is happening back in Europe, that these two, that there's an imaginary divide and that they are mutually informing one another, that you can essentially sequester that violence. Now, it's a fascinating argument that Arendt developed in the late 1940s and 1950s and has recently become very popular again as historians have delved into the complicated relationship between fascism and imperialism. And I mentioned Arendt, and I contrast this somewhat with Amis Azar, who had similarly been taken up in fascist studies. He is the author of the incredible book called Discourse on Colonialism, which is published around the same time as Arendt. But really, and as I think today's discussion, I hope, has shown, both Arendt and Cesar are part of a much larger collection or a much larger group of anti-colonialists engaging with fascism and these crises that precipitated the Second World War. And Arendt is incredibly popular, justifiably so. César has sort of been picked up in the sort of mainstream of fascist studies. But outside of these two, most narratives and histories of fascism have ignored a lot of what anti-colonialists are saying. And this gets back to what I mentioned at the beginning, right? This debate over whether fascism existed outside of Europe. And if you think no, which was the case for so long, you have no impetus to sort of search for these voices. But now that the field has sort of shifted in this direction, I think it's important to sort of acknowledge that while Arendt is very much a compelling historian, we should absolutely keep engaging with their scholarship, that anti-colonialists made similar arguments well before she did. And I think it's important to acknowledge this, and in doing so, bridge the divide that exists between scholarship on fascism and colonialism, as well as to say anti-fascism and anti-colonialism. Because I hope, as sort of today's discussion has showed, it can unearth really interesting and fascinating avenues of scholarship moving forward.
No, absolutely. I think that doesn't really, I mean, that by itself isn't making the point. The whole thing together, right, is coming together to make these points. So thank you for kind of ending us with that lovely conclusion. I do, however, have one final question. Given that answer kind of almost had in some ways a sort of rousing call to work more on this, what are you working on now that this book is done?
Oh boy, that's the dreaded second project question. I am currently writing a sort of chapter in an edited volume on the global response to fascism, and I have begun to sort of put together a book project centered on the outbreak of the early weeks of the Spanish Civil War. It's still early days, and I need to sort of get back into the archive, but I sort of want to return to my sort of roots to really sort of dig into the Spanish Civil War as this sort of, you know, important monumental interwar conflict.
All right. So maybe we'll have you back when that's ready.
No pressure.
Don't worry. In the meantime, listeners have plenty to be getting on with because they can read the book we've been discussing, titled Anti-Colonialism and the Crises of Interwar Fascism, published by Bloomsbury. Michael, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
Thank you so much. This was a lot of fun.